And they say dogs should be on a leash, but at like 7 in the morning on a Sunday morning, they're not patrolling and there's no one else around. He's really quite happy to run all over the place. So Billy, down you go. Down, mm-hmm. Down.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. Yep.
Billy, you want to sit here?
Billy, you've got to settle.
Billy, you're very cool.
I just don't want him bothering people. Chloe, you going to...
Okay, folks, I think we're going to start. It's 25 of 8, and I'm happy that Helen Fremont is here. This is her second time as a writer in resident at the Writers' Center. And second time for Billy here, too, who likes it up here as well. Helen came up here around the same time last year. Her first memoir, After Long Silence, was published in 1999, and it brought her in contact with family members that she had never known existed. Helen and her sister had been raised Roman Catholic, and it wasn't until when she was in her 30s that she discovered that she actually was Jewish. Her parents were Holocaust survivors. So Helen has done, I'm really curious what Helen's been working on. I don't know what she's going to talk about tonight, but I'm sure it'll be of interest to everyone in the room. So Helen Fremont.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Thank you. And thank you for coming out here. I'm aware that they're giving up at least the beginning of the Red Sox. Path to glory. And any event, the first book, I'm a very slow writer, and it took 6 years to write the first book, and this one seems to be taking... can everybody hear me? Yes?
A little louder.
Louder, okay.
This is not for...
Okay.
This is just for the tape. So
okay, so I won't lean into it. Billy is rather distracting. He will settle down eventually. So the first book took me 6 years to write, and this one, it was about finding out what my parents' true story was, because they had kept their identity a secret. And it wasn't until my older sister and I did research and found out that in fact we had all of these family members that we had never known about, but the way we found out is pages of testimony about how they had all been gassed or starved or shot or murdered. So it was sort of, surprise, you have a giant family, and surprise, they were all murdered during the war, and surprise, you're Jewish. And so it was trying to come to terms with our parents who were in their 70s and try to talk with them and try to encourage them to talk with us and not, I'm sorry, he is rather distracting, but we'll
bring him.
He's fine? Okay. Yes, he's jealous. So what I left out of that book, so that book was meant as a tribute really to my parents, because I have always been in awe of them. And then when I found out actually what had gone on, my father, I had always known, was imprisoned in the Gulag by Stalin. He was basically sentenced for life, and he escaped 6 years later in 1946. And my parents had been engaged to be married before the war, but the war came, he was sent off to Siberia. My mother dressed up as an Italian soldier and cut her hair short and marched out of Poland with the Italian army, and she was arrested. You know, so they had these dramatic, dramatic Dr. Zhivago love story. And then in 1946, my father escaped and walked across Europe by night because he had no papers, and found my mother in Rome, and they were married 10 years to the day since they had first met. So I'd wanted to write that love story, and then it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I thought, oh wow, there's much more than that. It's much more than a love story. It's really finding out that how my mother survived. Anyway, so after having written that book, what I had left out was all of the craziness that was in our family. And I really gave my sister and me short shrift and painted us in only the nicest light, that we really did come together and work hand in hand. Neither of us could have found out all of this or approached our parents. It was very painful to ask them to talk about that, and at first they resisted. And so it really was, I would never have done it without my sister, and I could never have written the book without my sister, although what I left out of the book is that she sort of turned on me at the end, and we were estranged, and we still are, and, it, you know, all sorts of sort of the underside of the family story, and very much a Children of Holocaust survivor story, which is, you know, when it went unspoken, and even though it was kept a secret, or some part of it was kept a secret, there's a lot that affected us, and it made us pretty loopy, pretty crazy, and, you know, drove us to, you know, ineffective family therapy in the 60s in Albany, New York. And I think I maybe in the first book touch on that a little bit, you know, that, you know, my sister and I would be fighting over, you know, like, wait, that's my T-shirt, that's my pen. And my parents would say, I survived the gulag for this? You know, get, you know, the perspective was like completely whack. So it really, like, our lives could never compare to theirs. And whatever, you know, little tragedies I had in my life, like, you know, I broke my, I don't know, toy, that was not going to cut it when, yeah, I lost my mother and father and my brother, and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So what I've been struggling to do since then is revealing the story of my parents' Jewish identity, however flattering it may have been, devastated my mother. And so my parents are both, my mother actually just died this summer at the age of 94, and I have been completely disowned and cut out. And it's not, I mean, if you read the first book, you would think that is shocking, because there is no hint of anything other than little hints that we went to therapy when I was 11 or 8 and those sorts of things. And so I really felt there's a whole other story, and that's my life and my sister's, and that my sister and I have actually, as a result of, I mean, it takes a family, you know, it doesn't take a village, it takes a family to really get to it. And I thought I should be more forthcoming and try to make sense of the whole, the second generation, and the sort of the intergenerational effect of trauma. And Billy, as the third generation, is obviously not having a problem with that. So
we'll have to explain to everybody who's listening to this on the web that there's a dog in the room that is shaking his toy, which is why the sound is like picking up through.
Yes.
Heavy breathing and growling.
Yes, that is not Helen. I just want to get on the record. That's not me. But I'm sorry for that. And he usually isn't this excited. He's just happy to be here. So I will read a few sections from what I'm working on now. And I started working on this in 2002. And I didn't think I was writing what might be considered a book until probably a year and a half ago. And so I was just writing things that I needed to put on the paper and tinker with it, to move around and find out why does this strike me as important and what's there. And that's why I thought with memoir, it's what I'm finding all these years that I'm working on it is that the past never stays still. It's constantly changing. It doesn't stay fixed. And our memories have to keep up with, it's sort of like you're driving down a road and you're looking in the rearview mirror, and you can't just focus your attention on the past, that what you see in the rearview mirror is constantly being folded into what you're doing now with your life, how you're living your life, and it is the context within which you look back. And so I think that that's the whole point with memoir, is being patient with the fact that the scene you wrote yesterday about what happened when I was a little kid is different when I come to it a month later, and when I come to it a year later. It has different resonance. And so the problem then is, when do you draw the line? I mean, at a certain point, a book just has to end. You can't just write on and then go back and revise. And so I'm very much in this process of finding my way through the mountain roads. And it would really be helpful for me if you say, you know, I'll just pick a few, not completely random sections, but sort of random sections, and you could let me know, if you could let me know what works, what doesn't, what you want to find out, anything like that would be great. And also to give a chance to people to just ask, or, you know, it's a small enough group, we can have an informal conversation. So I'll start with 1961. Childhood, 1961. For years, I tried to kill her. Every night, I would lie in bed in my room, close my eyes, and begin like this. She's 9 years old, and I'm 6, and she's chasing me through the woods with the baseball bat. She's twice my size, but I'm more agile, and I know exactly where the rusted barbed wire fence is, almost invisible between the trees marking property lines. I zip under it. She's barreling after me, blind with rage, and hits the barbed wire at full speed, right in the neck. Whack! And she falls to the ground, head severed. Or this. We're in my mother's 61 Rambler. Me in the back seat as usual, Laura in front, yelling at my mother. I hate you, my sister shrieks as we're careening down Route 9. Laura throws open the door, just to scare my mother. But at that moment, the road curves, and Laura tumbles out and is run over by 20 tractor trailers. My mother is desperately upset, and I pretend to be too. Or this. Laura comes at me with a carving knife, only this time, instead of running away, I tackle her. We fall to the floor, kicking and fighting. Suddenly, she goes mysteriously limp, and when I get up, I see that she has fallen on the knife, and it's buried in her stomach in a pool of blood. Each night, I ran through a dozen ways to annihilate her. In each version, she always started the fight that ended in her death, and in each version, I watched with apparent innocence and quiet delight. The fact is, neither of us was very good at killing one another. But Laura did manage to put me in the hospital in 1961. The plan was simple. Lure the little one to the top of the stairs and, surprise, send her flying. When Laura tried it, she was 7 and I was 4, and it was a brilliant success. Genuinely shocked, I soared through the air and landed in a pretzel at the bottom, blood gushing from my mouth. I must have let out a scream, or maybe Laura ran for my mother. My mother was lifting me up. There was a towel or dish rag or something turning red in her hands, and she ran for her purse and car keys and rushed me to the hospital. At the emergency room, Mom told them I'd fallen down the stairs. Laura pushed me, I tried to say, but my tongue wasn't working properly. I'd nearly bitten it off in the fall. They sewed it back together and sent me home. After I could talk again, I told my mother that Laura had pushed me down the stairs. Oh, no, darling, it was an accident. You fell down the stairs. I didn't fall. Laura pushed me. My mother stroked my hair and curled it behind my ear. No, darling, Laura told me she wasn't even in the kitchen. You must have tripped and fallen down the stairs. Laura didn't look at me in the eye for weeks after that, but I started killing her 100 different ways every night. The battle was engaged. So, obviously, not a nice little girl that I was, but that was like as little kids. I think there's the usual sibling rivalry, but I think it was sort of taken up a notch in our house, which seemed kind of normal to us. But in writing back on those scenes, I really, you know, here I'm not afraid of my sister. I probably am able to beat her up if it came to that. But I realized how terrified I was as a little kid, and it made me really angry. And so I thought that the problem I was having was really seeing this clearly. Instead of it being, poor me, she tried to kill me, I realized that that's not entirely the only part of the story. The other part of the story was I was trying to kill her. It's just that I wasn't large enough to do so. So I thought that in memoir, we think of the point of view always being, you know, painfully and boringly centered in the eye of the narrator. And so I tried to, at times in writing this, try to put myself in my sister's shoes and try to imagine what her point of view would be. And of course, since it is memoir, it's supposed to be nonfiction, and since I don't have my sister's quotes on this, I'm sort of making it up, but imagining it. So I don't know if it works, but I'll try just what I try to do on that. Looking back on those times, I can picture my sister lying awake in bed each night, wondering what I was up to in the next room. Well, I was trying to kill her in the next room. Perhaps she envisioned me sleeping like a little princess, breathing through my precious little nostrils, my hands flung in any direction, my sheets and blankets as undisturbed as the moment I'd made the bed that morning. I had huge eyes that seemed to drink in the entire world. I imagine she would have liked to gouge them out, pour their contents into hers. Why did I drop off to sleep like a puppy at the snap of one's fingers? What did I dream about drifting on my lily pad of undisturbed life? Everything was too easy for me. I opened my mouth and words came to me. I closed my eyes and sleep embraced me. I went to school and children played with me. Laura could not make sense of a person like this. There must be a secret to me, a secret evil that allowed me the illusion of ease. I imagine Laura longed to take me apart as one itches to take apart a radio to discover the source of the sound, as if one could understand its parts and somehow recreate the magic in herself. I appeared to be as natural as a blade of grass, and the freedom with which I swayed made Laura want to snap me off at the roots. For Laura, nothing came easily. She was in constant battle with herself and with the world around her. Night fell, and her eyes snapped open with the certainty of danger. Enemies filled her room, hid in her closet, slipped between the sheets of her bed, fell between the radiator, leaked under the windowsill. If she closed her eyes, they would spring out to get her. The voices began as whispers, then grew louder. She would tell me years later. Everything buzzed. Her bed began to move. She leapt from it and stared at it, but of course now it was still. It was taunting her. The curtains fluttered. She lifted one corner and traced the pattern of movement across the fabric, a wave on a beach. So elusive, the shadows. The creatures had no shape or form, but only a function, to hurt her, to laugh at her, to twist her into knots. So my sister was really, as kids, was the quote-unquote problem child, and I was busy being the perfect child, although, to be honest, I was, you know, trying to undo her as much as she was undoing me. And over the course of our lives, you know, I think she continued to fulfill that role in the family until I got to be my 20s. And even though she was really sort of always on the edge, in fact, in college she was hospitalized for 3 months, but she was also very, very high functioning. And so she managed, even though there were setbacks, she managed by the time I get to the next section, she was in medical school and I was in law school. And I think that is when, by the time I had finished college, by the time I'd finished college, that's when I was starting to have my own problems that were undeniable. And that's, my sister and I really had started to bond, and I was starting to realize that all of my childhood fears, of course, had dissipated because now we were the same size. We had the same interests. We really liked each other. We were actually incredibly close. And throughout our lives, it's always been either or. Either, you know, she was at my throat and I was at hers, or we were inseparable, totally, totally bond together. So, actually, there's a lot of death and killing going on in all of these. I didn't mean that to be the... I seem to have picked the only sections with that. But anyway, so the next section is when she and I were very close, and we made a suicide pact, as all siblings do when they're really, really tight. In 1980, my sister and I fell in love with death. In our separate apartments, in our separate cities, we considered suicide. I was in law school, and she was in medical school. And to the untrained eye, we appeared bound for success and happiness. The future billowed before us, a giant unfolding tablecloth. All we had to do was set the table and sit down to the feast. I'd always planned to be larger than life. I wanted to be proof that Hitler and Stalin had not won. Helen, historical gladiator, vanquishing the past by shining at her studies, eating all her vegetables, cleaning her room. But now, at 23, I knew I was not worthy. The obligation was too great. I owed my parents my happiness and my life, and suicide seemed like the fastest way to get out of debt. Also, there was the terrible burden of make-believe, the pressure of pretense, that I could no longer sustain. Our family had always looked fine from the outside. Our surfaces sparkled. Our lawn was green. Our grades were good. Our expenses paid. A double suicide would certainly give lie to all that. We were frauds, desperate to appear successful and well-adjusted on the outside while harboring the rage and grief of a destroyed people. Suicide would be more honest. My sister and I felt a certain sense of entitlement to apocalypse. My father had dismissed our unhappiness as the ennui of privileged youth. We were bored and restless and unhappy, he explained, because we had too much of everything. And he seemed to be right. Our lives had become too easy to bear and therefore unbearable in light of all that had come before. Hardship would do wonders for us, Laura and I believed, but neither of us wanted to give up too much comfort for the sake of happiness. We would rather be miserable. I think a car crash, I said. I was sitting on the shag carpet of my one-room apartment across from Boston College. The apartment was the shape of a caboose, and it had been built onto the side of a brick house to serve as the home office of a clinical psychologist. He had moved out after his divorce, and his ex-wife now rented the space to me. I cradled the phone receiver against my ear while doodling on my tax notebook. "What about you?" I asked. Laura sighed. The world turned on its axis with that sigh. Wind fluttered through the trees. Stars died. I think knives. Laura, the doctor, scalpel in hand. She had taken anatomy twice, her first year in med school and then the summer afterwards for good measure. Or drugs, she added. What drugs? Ah, there's zillions of meds. I can get anything I want. Medical school had its advantages, I could see that. I tried to imagine swallowing a bottle of pills and lying on the narrow bed against the wall of my room. It seemed too depressing. I want more of an impact, I told Laura. I want something noisier, faster, explosive. Drugs are so passive, so quiet. I mean, why bother? She didn't answer. A car crash would be fast, it would be active. It wouldn't be like lying around waiting to die. Listening to myself, I wondered how serious I was. Would I really kill myself? I didn't think so, but I thought Laura might. It doesn't matter how, she said. It's all the same. Nothing matters. Okay, but I'm just saying, it doesn't matter how you do it, Helen. When my mother had been my age, she was smuggling food to her parents in the ghetto by night. By day, she pretended to be Polish Catholic and worked in the Aryan section of Lvov, and by October 1942, she'd escaped Poland altogether, posing as a young Italian infantryman. She had lost her fiancé to the Russians, her parents to the Germans, and her sister to the Italians, until finally she had lost herself as a person whom she could recognize at all. And now, as a third-year law student, I did not know who I was or what I was doing. No one was trying to kill me. No one was shooting my friends or gassing my loved ones. What right did I have to be unhappy? My inner and outer worlds did not match. I was starting to break down, and I turned to my big sister as my model of decompensation. "Let's just do it," Laura said. Her voice was so low I could barely hear her. "Yeah?" "Yeah," she said. "Okay." The idea of killing ourselves together had growing appeal. It would be more like a mission, a bond we would share, something that would draw us together. "When?" "This weekend," Laura said. I had nothing planned this weekend. It would be a perfect time to kill myself. "You serious?" I asked. My sister was the most unreliable person I knew. It would be so like her to set something up and then back out at the last minute with some lame excuse. "Yeah." "Me too," I said. I wondered what my obligation was. If we agreed to do it, and I finked out, would I be responsible for her death? If I went through with it, she'd better kill herself too. Otherwise, what was the point? What exactly was the point? "All right," I said. "So what day? Saturday?" "I don't know. Maybe, or maybe Sunday." Here we go, I thought. She can't even commit to the day. She's never been able to make a decision in her life. I felt my aggravation rising. "Well, pick one," I said. "I'm not sure yet." "Well, you're sure you want to do it, right?" "Oh, yeah." "Well, I don't want to talk you." I said, "I want to do it." The sun was out. In 2 hours, the Red Sox would host the Yankees at Fenway. It all sounded so crazy. Laura and I were being dramatic. She had tried to kill herself before, but my depression was sharp and fresh. I wanted to be serious enough to go through with the plan, but I was pretty sure I didn't have the guts. It all seemed so unreal. "Then we'll do it," I said. "Together," she said. "Well, you do it your way, I'll do it mine." I didn't think we should have to synchronize our acts, but I needed her support and she needed mine, and together we might be able to pull it off. "All right," she said. "This weekend." We were quiet for a moment. "So what are you going to do now?" I asked. "I don't know." "Are your roommates around?" "No, they're never here." She lived with a group of med students who barely skimmed the surface of the planet. They studied all day and night. They partied and slept with each other between classes. My sister was isolated by a scrim of gloom that her roommates could not guess lay behind her convincing smile. I had spent my life distancing myself from her, and now I was closing the gap. We were not so different after all. We were both lost. "You all right?" I began to worry that she might kill herself ahead of schedule. "I'll be all right once we do it," she said. We hung up and I felt better. Maybe it was not the healthiest of relationships, but Laura and I bonded well over suicidal depression. It felt good knowing that she was also depressed. I didn't feel so alone. And there was something we could do about it. We could kill ourselves. I felt an obligation to her. I would have to find a road on which I could really slam into a wall without killing anyone else. I had to do it responsibly. I would not be a menace to other drivers. When I did it, I would do it right. So I'll stop there. How are we doing?
Excuse me, how far are you apart geographically?
Geographically, I live in Boston, she's in Syracuse, so about a 6-hour drive, not that far. And it's interesting, we grew up in Albany, and we each went, you know, in the opposite direction, about 2.5 hours, 3 hours, you know.
It's hard to synchronize the suicide.
I know. Well, yeah, we didn't do it. That's the good news, we didn't do it.
How did you not do it?
Yeah. It's a really anticlimactic moment. I'm not sure if I printed out the next thing. Oh yeah, it does. It's very boring. The weekend came. My conversation with Laura seemed ages ago. I wasn't in the mood for suicide, and I was pretty sure she wasn't either, and anyway, neither of us called. I didn't even think about it until Sunday night, when I vaguely wondered whether maybe she'd gone ahead and done it. But I knew she hadn't. It wasn't until a week or two that Laura called. We talked for a while, both of us miserable, but neither of us mentioned our suicide pact. Apparently, it had expired for lack of interest. I was too ashamed to raise the subject, the topic. Looking back on it now, I think we needed our pact to get us through whatever blackness had descended. Talking about it had given us a chance to put it out there in the air and send it across the wires without someone calling the cops on us. For that half hour or 40 minutes that we had talked about it, we had gotten some relief, some acknowledgement that we weren't alone, that we were, in fact, normal Fremont girls, since both of us were suicidally depressed. If we weren't both feeling exactly the same way at the same time, whether up or down, then one of us was abnormal. Or rather, by definition, both of us would be abnormal, since there was no norm unless we both shared it. Which, I'm not sure if that makes any sense, but, it's more thinking through. That was the bond that I had with my sister. Everything was great as long as we were on the same page. It didn't matter whether we were suicidally depressed or whether we were both really, really high. We spent a lot of time hiking and doing heavy labor and all that sort of thing, and we both were, you know, blissfully engaged and happy together. Or we were both happily suicidally depressed together, but the problem would always come if one of us wanted what the other didn't. And so, how many people here have siblings? How many people? You don't have a sibling?
No, I do.
Oh, you do. Okay. You don't have to raise your hand. You don't have to participate. But I'm just curious. Okay.
I need to ask another question.
Oh. How many are the oldest sibling? Okay, I have so many people have talked to me about the sibling order and the, you know, if there are two, if they're the same sex or the opposite sex, and, you know, it's I should do a study on it. There have been studies done on this, but I find it, siblings, a very interesting, obviously to me anyway, topic, and usually I find that, I don't know whether people who are older sibs, do you want to say something about it? You older
what
sibs? Chloe, yeah.
I think that there's definitely, an equation to how siblings, act to one another. I read this book once about, how it works, how family dynamics work. So, the first sibling and the second sibling always have, a lot, not in common. Do not have a lot in common, sorry.
Mm.
And then the second one and the third one are always fighting.
Huh.
And the first one and the third one are, friends. I don't know. It's just
huh.
Funny.
Well, we didn't have enough. My parents stopped, so we didn't get the third option.
Mm-hmm.
But how about you, Annie?
How about me?
Yeah.
I was 7 years younger than my sister and 9 years younger than my brother, and my sister tortured me.
Tortured, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
She did what?
Tortured me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were you younger?
7 years younger.
No.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, I think that's pretty standard.
I didn't torture my sister.
I know, but no older sibling thinks they did. Who else was the older sibling? Did you torture them?
I was the younger.
Oh,
two,
you were the younger.
So if you want to get onto that, it was male, female.
Oh, see, that's a different dynamic. So did your brother torture you?
Oh, a little bit. I mean, sometimes he would, let me see, I'd be pouring the soda and he'd pull the cup away and be all over the foot. But nothing really. I actually threw a cinch belt I would hit him with, or, you know, pop him.
Yeah.
But we got along okay, and he was my protector. We lived in an apartment building, so if anyone else was teasing me, he'd take care of them. Tell them to leave me alone.
Yeah.
Then I thought we were getting along. When he got married, it all ended. And then I heard from other sister-in-laws that that's what happens. The sister-in-law pulls him away, and pulls him away from the mother also.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother and father got older. It ended as soon as the estate was settled. He won't answer the phone. And I call, I just let it. But it's just, I don't know what's going on.
Wow. What's your question?
I was just going to ask you a question about the, I'm so interested in the connection between the sections that you read and what you knew about, what you learned about your heritage and what happened to people in your family. And I'm just thinking about the consequences of all that. And I had just been reading some I.D. Lang called The Divided Self.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that was on our bookshelves when I was growing up. I think that was, I mean, and of course I don't know, and nothing has trickled down since that time. So I, you know,
Did your parents read a lot? I mean, they're well
read? Yes, they're very, very well read. And,
there is something about Holocaust survivor children. So that's another segment that's all by itself and is being studied now.
Yeah, we really are pretty messed up. I mean, I don't know. I have participated in a number of second generation groups, and it's really true. The third generation finally have their act together. They kind of are almost normal. I mean, not that they're perfect, but you know, the thing about our family is, you know, there was a time when I was in law school, that third year of law school, when my sister and I were talking suicide pact, I actually was seeing a shrink, and my father came out because my shrink had said, you know, I don't think your father realizes how depressed you are. And my mother and I weren't speaking to each other. My father came out, and like the third word out of his mouth was, I just want to kill myself. And so we spent the entire session talking about my father's plans to kill himself. And then my mother wished, you know, it was just like, really? And I can't help but think that that is the aftermath. I mean, the trauma. And there's so many Holocaust survivors who did kill themselves, you know. And I think that my parents managed not to. But I think the transference of that kind of, it's just too much trauma to absorb in one generation. And, you know, not that you know, only Holocaust survivors get to have this sort of, you know, wacko acting out by their kids. But, you know, it's not like you need to find too many reasons. I think we're all capable of doing
it. Well, one of the things that bothered me in the first reading was that she defended her daughter, your sister, and said that she didn't push you, you fell. And she said to you, oh, she wouldn't do that. And here she's a survivor and sees what humanity is doing to humanity, killing. That they're really terrible people, and she didn't see that in her own children, that this could be happening, unless she was defending her and didn't want to deal with.
I think
maybe the threat of denial is working here, because if somebody were denying the Holocaust experience with your parents,
right.
Now she's denying this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you must be feeling awful that you're not being believed.
Affected, you know.
It's like a typical parent thing.
Yeah, I think that's...
But, you know, I'm curious about this hiding that goes on among Jews about this. In some sections, I've heard a lot of this situation. Marilyn Albright?
Oh, sure, Madeleine Albright. Yeah, yeah.
She didn't know. I have a lot of Jewish friends, Polish friends, who know, you know, don't hide anything, and they talk about it.
Right.
Yeah, my husband, who's not Jewish, but he was in a concentration camp, there's no secret about it. So, I'm curious.
Yeah.
Cousins, but they only talked to the adults about it. The children were never exposed to
those
stories. My
husband's children, our children knew perfectly well what he had gone through.
Yeah. I think that's...
survival was conditioned on hiding.
Not my father's.
No.
This was all my mother and her sister, and that's the other, which I didn't talk about at all tonight, but there's sort of two sets of sisters. My mother's sister also survived, and my mother's sister was instrumental in saving my mother's life, which I don't really, I mean, I go into in the first book, I map out exactly how how that happened, and in this one, I'm examining more the relationships between, and the expectations for what my relationship with my sister would be based on my mother's relationship with her sister. And it was, for the two sisters, they were so passionately in love with each other, is that both of them considered their husbands really just sort of extraneous. And yeah, it was sisters are what it's all about, you know, and that's who you really, really owe your loyalty to. And yeah, you need a husband, but you got to feed him, you got to do all this other stuff with him. But really, where the soulmate, that is your sister. That is the person you can rely on to, you know.
Well, you said your mother escaped to Italy by wearing an army uniform.
Yes.
Did your sister send it to her?
Not quite. It was more complicated. But my aunt was the older sister. My mother is the younger sister, and my aunt had actually gone to Rome to get, after she graduated college, there were quotas in Poland, so she couldn't get into the University of Lwów to study chemistry. So she went to Italy. And was able, and there she fell in love with. She had to get special permission. I don't know, to get a visa or in order to get the papers to go to this university. And so she fell in love with the director of the head of the Ministry of Arts and Sciences, who was, I think he was 20 years her senior, and he was a count, and he was a lawyer, and he was, you know, like a mucky muck in Mussolini's government. And he pursued her, and she was Jewish. She knew she wasn't going to be able to marry this, you know, this count. And so finally, but he insisted, and he knew that she was Jewish. And I still don't know the details of when they were married. In the first book, I thought they were married before the war. I have since found relatives who said, oh, no, she was still sending letters. So I don't know exactly when they married, but anyway, she had this guy who was... and they did ultimately marry, and my uncle is really the only Roman Catholic in our family. He's the only true blue, you know, regular Catholic, and he did help save my mother's life and also friends of theirs because of his connections, and you know, at that point Italy and Germany were allied, and so. He was able to, in fact, my aunt wound up it's too much history, but anyway, my aunt ended up stuck in Lwów for 2 years when the Russians took over, and my uncle was able to get her back. And then my aunt, while she was in Lwów, stuck there, she introduced my mother to the Italian officers, and so got my mother a job. And that's how my mother was dissembling. My mother was really switching between two identities every day. At night, she would be the Jewish daughter, and smuggle food to her parents in the ghetto. In the morning, she'd take off the armband and go across town into the Aryan section, and she had a new name, and she was the Catholic sister of this Italian countess, and she worked in the Italian officers, and she took a little apartment, although she didn't stay there, but she rented a little apartment, and then she was living two different identities every single day, and she kept her parents alive for 2 years that way, until finally they were just liquidating the ghetto altogether, and the Italian officer, she threw herself at the mercy of the Italian officer and said, "Here, these are my parents, we're Jewish, and help us." And he did, and so he helped, you know, he saved her life, and he, this is all in the first book, he got them to, he managed to get a taxi or a car to take them out to the village, so the city of Lwów was being emptied of all Jews. And in the village where they had relatives, it was still quiet. So this Italian officer managed to get them a car to go to the safer village. And my mother at that point had to leave her parents. And she wanted to go with them. But her mother was the one, talk about suicide and death. Her mother was the one who said, "You can't come with us. You have to escape. You're young. You can still escape. They can help you." And my mother knew that without her, her parents couldn't survive. They would immediately be discovered as Jews, and that was the hardest part of her. You know, she still feels that she abandoned her parents, and she doesn't have any illusions that she could have saved them, because she knew, you know, that she it was impossible. Everyone was killed. but she felt that she should have died with him. That was growing up. That was what she would always say. If you know, if my sister and I would get into a fight, she would say, she would fall to the floor and just say, "Boja, boja, boja, God, 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 I should have died with my parents. I should have died with my parents. This is God's punishment." You know, it's like, okay, never mind. We're really fine, Mom. It's okay. Never mind. We get everything's good. You know. But
I have a question about history. How did the Italians find themselves there? Because it's a long way from Italy to Poland.
Right.
How were the Italian officers in Poland at that time?
In well, it started, okay, 39. In 39, the Germans move east, and the Russians, they had a Molotov Ribbentrop. Okay.
Yeah.
So they get, so it's Russia till 41 in Lvov.
Right.
And then in 41, the Germans take over. The Italians are allied with the Germans, and so the officers were.
Why do the Italians?
Because they were allied. This was part of the. So they had.
The distance between.
But they had. They had stations.
And Italy.
Yeah, but all through those countries in between, they had. They were stationed in Munich. In.
The Italians were.
The Italians were right. They were. I mean, yes. In Lvov, the Italian officers were, they didn't have fighting forces, they didn't have troops, they had logistics.
The only thing I know happened was that the Russians got some Italians to help them fight the Germans in Stalingrad, but that's, again...
That's way farther than Lvov, that's, yeah. Yeah.
So how did the, because I asked my Jewish friends if they knew of any Italians during the war in Poland. They never heard of it.
Hmm.
So it's there must be some connection there, some explanation, but it's a puzzle.
Did they go to work? You said they just had a presence there.
It was administrative. It was a logistics. It was sort of like... we are fighting war in Iraq, but there are so many of us officers stationed in Kuwait, you know, and saying the French are in Kuwait and the English are in Kuwait. And
first you like the UN force with mixed nationalities.
Right, right, but not troops. I don't think Italian troops ever went that far. Well, yeah, I'm thinking of, you know, sort of, I picture the Italian army going out with their, I think these guys were...
Historically not correct.
Not correct. No. But I do not, at least from what I've learned, that there were Italians stationed in the major cities, and this was in the, you know, because Hitler was promising Mussolini part of the spoils. You know, this was going to be, basically the Germans were doing the dirty work, and the Italians thought, okay, that sounds good. And then when it looked like the Germans were going down, the Italians said, okay, I think we'll join the Allies now. And so. Well, and also they had a presence in Hungary.
Well, that's south of
Lvov. South, but southwest of Lvov. But but also, Lvov was originally an Italian, it was Leopoli. It was an Italian city. It was the fortress, the 12th century city that had been built by Italian, and the buildings there were built by Italians, Italian architects and Italian. It was a very westernized city of Leopoli. In Italian, it's Leopoli. In Polish, it's Lvov. In Ukrainian, it's Lviv, and...
So let's go back to the dynamics of your book, which is really...
How much of it did your mother tell you, and how much of it did you have to find out and then get her to confirm?
Everything had to be... My mother told us so many different versions at different times in our life, and also what was really strange is that once she finally let down her guard and just... There was a period in which actually we couldn't get her to stop talking about not so much the specific things about the war, because she did not want to talk about the really traumatic moments, but she did tell us an awful lot, except the one thing that she'd never admitted to that we found out from others in the family was that her parents, her family was Hasidic. I mean, they were very, very, very Orthodox. And my father, they were shtetl Jews. My father, too, his side of the family was, there was no such thing as reform or conservative or, you know, the pick and choose. You were either Jewish, in which case, you know, the whole thing, the beard, the robe, and they were very much Hasidic. And that's, for whatever reason, I don't know why, my mother would never admit that. Never in her life would she admit that to me. And I have pictures of my grandfather. It's like, and his name is not, what did she say? I can't remember what she said. She said her parents' names were Mark and Sophia. And her father's name was Moisha and Sarah. Never admitted to that. And I have a picture of my grandfather whose name was Zalman Shmuel, you know, and he has a beard that's longer than his legs. It's so I don't know what that means to her, that she admits that she's Jewish because we got it out of her. And actually, we told them, you don't have to tell us anything. You know, we know too much already. We are just trying to invite you to feel safe that you can talk to us
if
you want.
Did you practice Catholicism as a family in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, this is where it's, I feel like I was just, well, but my sister was also equally stupid about it, because my parents, like, I didn't know any better. I went to church with them, and we'd always sit in the last row. We'd sneak in a little bit late. We'd sit in the last row, and then we would sneak out of church right before Mass, before communion, not Mass, before communion, and my parents said, you know, it's not a very important part of the Mass, you know, and I thought, great, we're getting out of church early. I thought it was just really boring to sit around and blah, blah, blah. So I thought we were really special because I didn't have to go through that. She said, oh, Poland, we never had communion. So my parents never went to communion. They never, we'd leave the church.
They probably, and, you know, there was anti-Semitism. I mean, we stayed out of the war because it was not, all the truth wasn't known. But they came out of all that, and they came to a country where there was still anti-Semitism.
Oh, yeah.
So they must
yeah,
have felt it. And they were just waiting for the next purge or whatever was going to happen, so they just protected themselves.
Well, it was,
they,
I mean,
oh my God.
One of the things that I've realized in the, between the that book and this one, this is also something that I didn't touch on at all in here, is that the reason you were saying it's very unusual that Holocaust survivors would hide their Jewishness once they came to the States, and that's where the difference between my father and mother came in. My father said as soon as he set foot on American soil, he knew there was anti-Semitism, but he didn't feel scared for his life. He didn't care if people hated him. Fine, you know, you have a small mind, you're ignorant, whatever. It won't be the first time people hated him. But they weren't going to kill him. He felt safe. And my mother and her sister had this vow that they would never, never, never let the children know. So neither my cousin, because my aunt, and oh, that's the other part of it. So anyway, what I've come to realize is that the reason there is a secret is because my mother, I believe this officer who helped her, was her lover, and she was pregnant. And that was, when she came to Italy, her story was, oh, I was saved, but the uncle, the count, with the strings, got her into a concentration camp. But she would tell me about that concentration camp. This is during the war. They were fed very well. It was all of these women. Some of them were prostitutes, and they were all knitting. They didn't have work. It wasn't a work camp. I just realized it was, you know, they were probably in some convent for unwed mothers. And lo and behold, 9 months after my mother lands in Italy, she comes back, she's released even though the war's not over. This is now in June of 1943. And the story went that my aunt baked goodies and gave them to the camp warden so that, you know, she got my mother. And, you know, and it's possible, there are so many crazy stories about people, how the things happened in the war, that I would be the last to doubt anything. But I just realized that my cousin was born June 15th of 1943. And my mother and he are, his loyalty to my mother, they were together for for 8 years. My mother lived from 1943 until 1950. so almost 8 years, she raised this child. And my father would always talk about how bitterly angry he comes across Europe. He finds the woman that he was engaged to marry. They quickly, you know, arrange a wedding. My mother pulls him aside, said, by the way, we've got to have it Catholic. It's got to be Catholic. We're in, you know, Italy. He was like, he didn't care. He was alive. He didn't. But he really resented the fact that on the first night of his wedding, he had to share the room with this little crying baby. And he was like, really? I mean, because the child had always had the room with my mother, not with his mother. So it's that secret that I realize that both sisters, and of course my uncle was in on it, because they gave this kid, who would have been a bastard in Italy, he's a count. You know, he's not just, I was going to say kosher. He's a kosher count, which is actually true. But he is a legitimate child, and he is actually a count in a country that it matters, even though maybe a penniless count. My uncle didn't have any money. It was a medieval, you know, count. So anyway, it was a noble thing for them to do. But my mother left her son, I realize now, and came to the States, and that's why when my mother went to just a horrible, when she was pregnant with my sister, she fell into just horrible, horrible depression and couldn't function, couldn't get out of bed for long time. And that was before I came along. So that's what I'm getting into here, is that was the history that came out when I was 8 years old and we were all going to family therapy because my sister had thrown me down the stairs because she was like chasing me with a baseball bat or whatever.
Where's the boy now?
Pardon me?
Your older brother.
My older half brother is, he's in Italy. He married, and has one daughter, and that's how I know that. And his daughter, who now lives in New York, she works for Goldman Sachs or something. And she's pretty much a regular person. I mean, she thinks, oh, all of this drama. It's just like, really? Can't we just get along? What's the big deal?
She's a thief with Goldman Sachs.
Yes.
More drama.
I'd like to go back to your dialogue with your sister.
Mm.
I assume that's a back and forth dialogue in
yes.
your memoir.
Yes.
How much of it do you believe you created, or how much of it was recalled? You started out by pointing out very clearly, the moment you tell something, it's not the memory that it was.
Right.
The more times you tell a memory, the further you may get from
what actually happened. Yeah.
So I'm curious how you remembered the dialogue between you and your sister.
Well,
and then I have another comment, but I'd like to
okay. I actually was keeping a journal in those days. So I was keeping a journal. So I have a lot of these things that I've documented mm-hmm. that I also question. You know, that does not just because they're contemporaneously written does not mean they are reliable
mm-hmm.
because they are filled with whatever else. And let's face it, I was not exactly the most reliably, you know, well-adjusted, you know, person at that time. So for whatever was going on for me, certainly I was throwing into my journal. It's not like, you know, the minute you take any experience and try to form words, whether you write them or whether you speak them, you're already skewing the mm-hmm. truth of something because you can't, you know, to verbalize something is like translating real life into language, which already is a little bit of a, you know, there's a distortion, just a distortion effect. It's not a perfect thing. And then on top of that, there's all of this emotion and all of this, the wishes, the fears, the dreads. And so by the time you get even a newspaper article, well, it must be true, I read it in the newspaper. Well, certain things are probably true, you know, but then were the Italians in Lvov? I don't know, I read it somewhere. who knows?
Going along with what you asked, did you and your sister ever talk about that incident of the pushing down the stairs or anything that went on between the two as children?
No, that's another thing that we're really famous for is we don't talk about it. There's although there is a time that was really, and it was the year before the suicide pact. So in the second year, that's my sister did cut herself up, and I was at home, and I left, and my mother, she didn't cut herself until I left. And then my mother blamed it on me. She felt that because I wasn't there to help her take care of myself. All right, so that was a bad time. Now I've forgotten your question.
Whether you two ever talk about your
childhood
experience.
Yes.
So
after that period, my sister, my parents kept her. They didn't want her to be institutionalized, so they kept her at home. 24/7, my mother was caring for her and making sure she didn't take all the drugs and I wasn't allowed to come home because Fonda was very mad at me. Laura was furious.
Where'd you go?
I actually had a job in Troy, and I ended up not being able to live at home because my sister was, ballistic. And we did. My sister and I got together the following fall, and we sort of debriefed, and I said, well, I couldn't go home the whole summer because you wanted to kill me, and Mom and Dad were afraid of what would happen if I showed up. And my sister was like, what? That's crazy. They told me you didn't want to have anything to do with us.
Wow.
And that you wouldn't even, I was like, okay. Maybe they did tell her that. I mean, it's just so crazy. Who knows? But then I remembered that she had screamed at me, like I was there. And she said, you are dead. I will kill you if you show up. I called home, and I she pulled the phone from my mother. And it's like, wait a second. That's reality. That's my reality. She did say she was going to, and she was a raving lunatic, and I actually didn't have to just rely on my father to tell me that. But it is the truth of all of this. Who knows? But that's when I realized that. And then my sister did say, I was so drugged. They had me on so many drugs. I don't even remember what went on that summer. But she never admitted that she had ever threatened to do anything to me, So when I said, but don't you remember that phone call when I was on the trail and I called you, and she just went really, she started, she was very disturbed that I brought it up, and she could never acknowledge, and she just said, no, I thought you just had abandoned us, that you had nothing to do with us.
So in your journals, you didn't put down like conversation or then this is a dream or this is a fantasy. And then at one point you said that there were times when you had a night, I don't know if it's a night, but it would be like a night you would dream of different ways to kill your sister.
Yeah.
Fantasies of how to do hundreds. You said, how do you remember those? Did you also write those down?
No. Well, although I kept a diary when I was that little, but I was so, my sister kept breaking into my room and breaking into the diary that I never said anything of what I was feeling. I would say, well, it was really sunny today, and in gym class we played kickball. And I'm looking, the writer looks back on her early diaries to show signs of, the spark of creativity. No, it's just, it's ridiculous. So that is just the memories that I, because
amazing.
This was a recurrent theme. But again, you have to wonder how much of that is, am I feeding, but from now, what I remember of the, and I'm taking liberties. I don't think that I necessarily envisioned her being hit by 20 tractor trailers. I think it was probably like more a truck ran over her, and then another truck, and another truck, maybe not 20. It was ratcheted up, and it was how I kept myself, occupied.
Didn't the therapist also help you bring things up?
We had very, very bad experiences with therapists. and that's the other thing I do in this, oh my God. Because I had, like, when I was in law school, I went to see a shrink, and my whole, that was the one that my father came to and told about how he was going to kill himself. So we spent the entire, and I was like, Dad, you've come to help me? and he's like, yes, well, I know how I'll do it. I will, because he was a doctor, and he had, you know, all of the medicines in his office, and he went through it with my shrink, and I was like, but again, I never spoke with him again because I was just like, oh, I'm fine. That's fine. That's okay. Poor guy. I've got to be really, really good for him. But, so there are so many things that we didn't talk about that did not get mentioned.
I thought it was interesting that as you talk about this talk between the two of you about suicide, I don't know about the other people, but I almost laughed. It sounded humorous to me.
It is humorous, yeah.
It's very interesting that you do this. Tragic kind of discussion, but it's really humorous, and that's a real skill on your part to do that.
Oh, well, thank you. But it is sort of so bizarre. It's so
bizarre.
It's because we were, I mean, I didn't think I would do it, but I really, really got something out of talking about what I would do, and I would never, tell, and she would never tell a shrink because they would probably want to lock us up somewhere,
Well, I guess that therapy worked well then between you and your sister.
Between us, yeah.
That's a dance macabre.
Yeah.
What did you say, Anne?
Dance macabre. That's like some sort of all those ritualistic things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But the thing is, there's so much suicide that still takes place, and I hear of young people that are killing themselves, and there's more military people coming home that are killing themselves than fought in both Iraq and and Afghanistan. Then were killed in Iraq.
Yes.
There's
more suicide.
Yeah.
But I especially hear often about 18, 19 year olds.
Yeah. No, it was a very real. I mean, my sister. A few years after this, when she was a first year intern in psychiatry, she's a psychiatrist. But her first year as an intern, she did very nearly kill herself, and it's only because her roommate was a surgeon and managed to get to her after she had already stopped breathing and had no pulse, and her roommate, the surgeon, did CPR and got an ambulance, and she, basically got her back. And after that, my sister was still, this friend of hers, her roommate, who saved her life, after that was, a little less close to my sister and felt a little bit not friendly. And my sister could never understand it. She's like, I don't know what her problem is. And I was like, Mara, I mean, this was probably pretty, pretty traumatic for her. I mean, don't you think? Oh, that. It's sort of, she did not ever take the responsibility. Like, she was the one who was suffering. Now, why isn't her friend there for her? And I think that was also the theme between us. It's like, oh, all right, Helen. So, I mean, at one point I wound up in a battered women's shelter, and this was also after I went to Peace Corps, and I was on crutches. And it's a long story. But, did you have a question?
I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt.
No, please. I'm rambling.
I have a comment and a question.
Yes.
First of all, regarding suicide, there's nothing humorous about suicide. If any of us have known anybody that's committed suicide, not attempted.
No, committed.
Speaking about committed it, including a lot of the young military personnel coming back, it defies both psychopathology and explanation as to how one
does.
Takes that final event. So I don't think there's any humor in in this situation you described. I wanted to ask you, I'm from a culture in which Italian-American, Roman Catholic,
Okay.
And nobody in our family was in the Holocaust, but there were many secrets in our family. As Henry knows, and a couple of people here, I spoke about a memoir I wrote a few weeks ago. And to discover that my father was a member of organized crime when I was a college student at Columbia was a big secret in our family. But that's not the highlight. The highlight to me is that in our family, there were two rules. If you touched on certain matters, you don't ask no questions.
Right, right.
And the second is, the best way to keep a secret is to don't tell anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So with those two comments, I'm asking you, how are you able to, what do you think people's reactions are who read your book about your immediate family? I'm telling you now, I've finished it. It's done.
Mm.
And I've written other things too, but my point is, I omitted certain things, not the one about organized crime, but I omitted many things because of the people that are still alive.
Oh, yeah.
One doesn't want to hurt too many people.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, and I'm sorry it took me this time to ask it, what is your goal in writing your memoirs, if any?
Well, I think that the first one was critical in order for me. I think they both have to do with my sense of who I am, mm-hmm. which I really have not been able to get a handle on, because it was always my parents' story, and I had no right to it. It was, and I had no right in some ways to my own anything issues. It was what they wanted, mm-hmm. and I was hoping that by writing this, and my father was on board. My father was actually very, he was also a writer, and he wasn't the source of the secret, and he probably didn't know that my mother, that my cousin is my half-brother. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that was what was at stake, that my father never know, and that my half-brother probably does know, because I remember we talked about it. And he would say, oh, man, I wouldn't be surprised if X, Y, Z. And the two sisters would probably, you know, mm-hmm. definitely deny it. Of course they would deny it. But I think my father, I'm pretty sure, could not have known. The way he talked so bitterly mm-hmm. about and hated my cousin his whole life. He just really was so angry and jealous mm-hmm. about my mother's attachment. To him. But so why am I doing this?
Yeah.
I think that I was hoping that I could be both real to myself and to my family, and that they would accept me as such. My father did, my sister did, my mother did not. And that is sort of the crux of the matter, is that what I'm trying to figure out now is, it really does come down to my mother and me, and my mother and my sister. So I think, and everyone is safely dead now. My aunt is dead.
Excuse me, did your mother read any of your writing?
No.
And your father?
Yes.
I see.
Yes, he read, you know, I actually had shown him parts of the book before I wrote it. My mother knew I was writing it,
mm-hmm.
you know, so again, she didn't want to ask the details. I went to my aunt's house. I mean, when I took off time to write that book, I took off 6 months and lived with my aunt in Rome and was writing the book every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I was, it wasn't like a secret I was keeping.
But you said you were disowned, so who disowned you?
Well, it really turned out to be a package deal. My father died in 2001. My father was suffering from Parkinson's, and he had had it for probably 12 years before he finally died. And so he was not, and he was living at home. My mother would not ever let me come home or see him. So he didn't get that, and I was not allowed to see my father. And so with my mother took him to a lawyer and added a codicil that removed it. I don't even know whether my father was of sound mind, and whether he was or not, he did not have. He and I continued to correspond when he had Parkinson's, and after, when I came home, my mother invited me to come to the funeral because she has not spoken to me for 3 years, and he died, and she invited me to come to the funeral. It was the first time I was allowed to see her, and I was thrilled. And I went to the funeral, and then she invited me home. And then she said, and this is what's so bizarre, she told me about, and it was like so good to be back with Mom. She was warm and funny and friendly. And she said, you know, here's the deal that Dad and I made. You know, he wanted to still keep in touch with you. And I said, we just have different relationships with you. And, you know, as long as he could write your address on the envelope, and he would send letters that I could barely decipher towards the end, as long as he could do that, I made the deal. I would post the letters, because he couldn't walk, and she would get the letters. That was her agreement, you know. And she said, this is like, isn't it? And she said, but I was so relieved this year when he forgot your birthday and I didn't have to post the card. I was like, wow. And it was so bizarre. Her entire demeanor was so like, oh, isn't that the most sweet thing you ever? I didn't even hear her words. I was so taken by, I'm with my mother again, and she loves me, and it was on the car ride home, and I wouldn't have believed it if I hadn't been there with my partner, and we both didn't even think about it. We were like, oh, we're back home, and oh, Helen's going to be back with her mom. This is so great. And we both went, did she just say that? Did she say that? I can't believe she said that. And then the other thing was that my sister was involved because, again, my sister could not look at me that the whole time I came home from my father's funeral. She was, like, we sat across the table from each other. She was so unable. She could talk to my partner, but she had to go out and, like, chop wood. You know, she just disappeared. She finally came at the, when we left, she didn't say goodbye to me, or she said, like, hi, Helen. But to my partner, my partner said to her, thank you, Laura, you have been such a saint. You've been so good, because she did. She took care of my father. I mean, that's the irony, but, oh, God, I haven't even gotten into her accusation that my father raped her. Okay, so that'll be another story. But anyway, so my partner said, thank you. You have been really wonderful. You have been really Saint Laura. And Laura said to her, you won't think that when you know what I've done. And I didn't hear from my sister until I got the codicil. So the codicil also names my sister's closest friend. In the place that it said, remove Helen, remove Helen, remove Helen, and insert the name of her swim coach and best friend. So it's like it took my mother and sister to get that in the codicil, because my father wouldn't have known the name and address of my sister's swim coach from college. I mean, that. Anyway.
It's cruel. What's going on?
The secrets, the things that you don't say, fester. Don't you find that they grow? It's something that should be not that big a deal. I mean, the Holocaust is a big deal, but let's say, okay, you have a kid out of wedlock. That's a shame, but it's not worth, you know, killing yourself over, and it's not, but because it's suppressed, because it's kept a secret, and then what happens in these secrets is that there are those people who are in on the secret and those who are out, and there are these barriers, and it starts your relationships are skewed, mm-hmm. because whether people realize it or not, there's all this energy that's being tamped down, and it's going to come out in other really crazy ways. So
there's an expression in Italian. I don't speak Italian, but I speak it. The translation is, the more you stir something, the more it stinks. And that's what we're really talking about.
Yeah.
I've heard a very similar expression.
Yeah. You'll have to excuse me.
Thank you for your participation.
You.
That's great.
Is your memoir published too?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Be well.
Be well.
What's the title of it?
I want to get it.
Henry.
Well, tell me.
It's
called
here.
Buddy Remembers Then and Now.
Okay.
Be
thank
well.
You. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Henry. Contact. Thanks.
That's amazing.
So it's true. It's true. The more you stir something, the more it stinks. And I think that's why I've really just been wallowing, and I don't want to wallow anymore. You know, so I think there's something about control. The thing about writing is, you know, or working on any creative project, whether it be, you know, a painting, whether it be a piece of music or something, there's some exertion of control, and, you know, you get to put a frame around it. You get to put, you know, the covers of a book around it. Yeah, Chloe.
I'm just curious, I'm writing something similar about family, and there's definitely parts that I know that people would not want to be told or would not want
mm-hmm.
themselves expressed this way. And so how, obviously it's like
how what?
An easy way to deal with it, but like how
yeah.
do you deal with it? Like do you ever like, I don't know, what do you do?
I think, you know, people have, every memoirist has a story about, you know, because none of us lives lives of isolation. We are all interconnected, and what is, you know, that's what I struggled over, whether I had the right to write the first book. And I actually didn't see that this would be the outcome. I knew that my mother would be angry, but I knew that she knew I was writing about it and that she was okay with that. She wasn't at first, but she seemed to be after that.
Did she read it? I mean, maybe
no,
she wouldn't have liked
no,
what you said.
I'm sure
she
didn't.
Did
I'm
memoir,
sure
she
didn't read it.
Didn't
I'm sure she couldn't
spot.
Have. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but I'm pretty sure. Because when I sent it to my parents, my father wrote back within a week and said, I read the book and, you know, I'm sort of disappointed because a lot of the things that you said were things I had not intended for public consumption. But he said, but in the next paragraph, you know, so much for ethical squabbles. I think it's a really good book. Congratulations. It's well done. Da, 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 and on. And I never heard from my mother for 3 years until he died.
But don't you think your memoirs is also like, I want somebody on my side. You had so much negative stuff. And reactions from your family are negative. You go out to the world to say, here's me, believe me,
take yeah.
my side. I mean,
well, I think that what I hadn't anticipated is that, because my sister and I did, this was before the internet was out there, it was 1992, 93, we had done international research. We went to my parents' hometowns. We went to Israel. We went and we called all these survivors who remembered this and that and the other thing,
mm-hmm.
trying to find if there are any relatives. We only by publishing the book, like within a week, within I think less than that, 3 days after the book came out, I was sitting at work and I got a phone call from this woman. And she said, "Hi, I'm Susan Simon. I'm calling from Iowa City, and I'm your cousin.
Uh-huh.
And you know, I you wrote about my her father was the one who wrote the pages of." And she said, "Yeah, I remember you when we were little. You were she was older than I." She said, I was 16 and you were 4 and we came to visit, and after that your mother said we could never see you again because she was afraid that I would find out that we were related and that we were Jewish." And so these people that I remembered from when I was a little kid, I didn't know what the deal was. They were friends, family friends. That's all I knew. But obviously, they resonated. There was something. I didn't remember every friend that ever stayed with my parents. There was something about this that kids pick up. So anyway, I found out all these, and that was really powerful because once I got in touch with these people who remembered me as a little kid, and then I started finding out, whoa, my parents, they had photographs of my parents, like, recently were going to their kids' bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs. And my parents would tell me, oh, we're going to New York for a medical convention.
Yeah.
You know, and here were these pictures, my father
wow.
lighting the, you
oh
know, the candle or whatever, and he's wearing the and it's just like, wait a second, wait a second. This is crazy.
Did they ever do, they didn't do those stories for Steven Spielberg, you know, he's done
they weren't Jewish. They weren't survivors. They weren't Jewish.
Uh-huh. Wow. This
I mean,
it, you should write to Spielberg. I'm not kidding. This could be an incredible movie. Incredible.
It seems like
but you know, a memoir is a piece of literature like any other piece of writing.
That's true.
And there has to be a reason why you put certain things and why you leave certain things out. I mean, why
right.
do you, so
right.
why would you have to put something? Does it belong in the story or does it not?
Yeah.
If it doesn't, it's
yeah. yeah. And I did not feel any of the stuff with my sister belonged in that story. It was what the part that belonged in that story was we worked really, really well together and really hard, and we were really supportive of each other and in trying to come to terms with who we are. I could not have done it without her. She was phenomenal, and I think that we both were incredibly, incredibly tight. And so that comes out, but I didn't bother to say, oh, and then there were times when she tried to kill me, you know, or that sort of thing. You know, it just didn't, that book did not.
The other thing is you could write a wonderful personal essay on secrecy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know,
yeah.
And as a study.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that would be
very yeah. And my sister's mental illness was a huge secret. That was another thing
that's
that was
so
not allowed to.
People,
no one could speak
secret.
Of it.
A lot of people keep it a secret.
Yeah.
And why?
Yeah.
You know, as a sort of detached, objective person.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, in a lot of cultures, children are protected from horrible stories.
Mm-hmm.
James Baldwin has a story of. In his autobiography, the family just came back from a funeral, maybe somebody was shot, and they're all in the living room in New York, and they're talking and vigorously, and the children walk in, absolute silence.
Yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
And that's it, and I mean, my own father, we come in, you know.
But sooner or later. Yeah.
But, and that makes sense, that children shouldn't be exposed to horrors.
Right,
and,
right.
And I think the Holocaust was a secret for a long time. Mm. There was a lot of secrecy around it.
In the United States.
Oh yeah.
And it wasn't talked about.
The whole country didn't know.
It hadn't been processed. It wasn't understood. World War II was over. Celebrate.
Right.
And
right.
It took years before people could start to talk about it.
Well, it was a secret. You know, in the beginning, there was a Polish. Reporter, journalist who traveled between Poland and England, telling them what was going on.
Yes.
Nobody
believed
it.
Right.
So,
well,
yeah.
I went back to the therapist that my sister and I went back to the therapist that we saw, the psychiatrist who we saw when I was 8, and she had retired, and this was back in 92 when we were doing this research, and we found her, and she did remember us, and we said, did you know our parents were Jewish? And she said, no. Did you know they were Holocaust survivors? No. I was, you know, she knew that they had come out of the war, and she said, your parents wouldn't talk about it, and frankly, I was relieved. Nobody talked about that, and I didn't want it. You know, here's the shrink herself, the psychiatrist, is dealing with, I mean, that's why I think we had bad luck with psychiatrist, but that was not, she didn't even bother to go, oh, and by the way, what happened to you people before you, you know, produced these children in distress? It was something like they were just too happy to not bring it up. In fact, Primo Levi's book was, he wrote it,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't published until, it was what? In Italian.
And he killed himself.
So many.
Yeah.
Tadeusz Borowski killed himself, right?
Bettelheim.
Didn't he? What, and Bettelheim?
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's his name? The guy who wrote Mouse and Mouse.
Oh, Disney?
No, he didn't. His mother did. The Holocaust survivor did. So not the child of.
I've never heard it until today, and then just three different people have brought up this book.
Why am I blanking on his name? I know him.
Well, it was amazing when it came up, because it was a way to start talking about it with distance.
Yeah.
Because it was a graphic novel or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah.
And it was to comic, but it was one thing that I that strikes me in your family story, and there are so many people who come from Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And so whether they went through the Holocaust or just lived under, you know, the general oppression of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, they have this sense of, forget it, don't talk about it,
right.
Not deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very uptight when there's any kind of authority coming near. So, you know, my husband's family is Ukrainian, and, you know, he's starting to do some digging. And he comes in and he'll say, I just learned thus and so, and I'm looking at him, you're kidding me. Okay. But he, you know, if an authority figure, say a policeman, stopped at in the driveway and said, "What are you doing?" because they're, you know, taking a car apart, Michael's father would get, and my father would be, "Do you have a badge to ask that question?"
Wow.
Totally different culture.
Wow.
In a totally different sense, but he wasn't. His father wasn't afraid. He's just this sense of it's authority. You need to be careful.
Yes. Yeah.
And we don't know anybody over there. I don't care if they're relatives. We don't know them.
Right.
Don't answer the phone.
Right.
No, we're not related. I don't care who you are.
Yeah.
And my husband's the same way. I said, aren't you curious? This man says he knows, he knew your aunts. And no, we don't have any.
Yeah.
And it's the oddest sense, but it's a very, you know, it seems to be very specific to people who came out of that part of Eastern Europe, Austria-Hungary at that time. And it's such a contrast with the way we see other immigrants and immigrants' children behave.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that totalitarianism, if you just a little, goes a long way, you know?
It goes a long way, and it's lasting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Because my father was terrified of any policeman. Anybody is like, any authority figure,
yeah.
IRS, anybody. It was just like, look, I have everything in order, everything.
Oh,
can
yes.
I? Yeah.
All right.
Mm. For the Russian experience, the Soviet experience.
Mm.
And yet, if you don't bring these things out in a memoir or, you know, some kind of, bring it out and make it visible in some way,
yeah,
you act it out.
Right.
Exactly.
It
comes out one way or another.
It just keeps going on
yeah.
and on and on.
Yeah.
And the only way to break the cycle is to say, we're going to name it, we're going to look at it,
mm-hmm.
we're going to take and deflate all the power we've put into it.
Mm-hmm. And try to make sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
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 Although that's
suicide as being a you know, the theory of suicide as rage turned inward.
Mm.
And when you think of the amount of rage that has to be operating when you've been victimized and
yeah.
traumatized to that degree.
Yeah.
So
that's why it turned out to a
stick way, which you guys were acting out for your mother.
Mm.
You know, it's really interesting.
Yesterday I was watching something about Japan.
You heard other
mm-hmm.
people by killing yourself.
That's right.
What's
oh,
that?
Absolutely.
Just
what's that?
Hate turned outward because you hurt other people.
Yeah.
By killing yourself.
Yeah.
You imagine the hurt.
Yeah.
I was
it
watching
is.
An internet thing, and somehow they slip in another topic, like I was watching about Fukushima and the nuclear power plant. And all of a sudden, this one image on the list that comes down on YouTube, sometimes I put it, it was called the Suicide Forest. So it was in Japanese, and then it was translated into English, so I popped on that to see what they were talking about. And there's a suicide forest where people go to commit suicide.
To commit suicide.
The man who was narrating it, which was translated into English, was this man who goes out there every day to see what's happening and to things.
Well,
or
the Japanese culture, that's a totally
different
yeah.
dynamic. Yeah.
Yeah. But it was really, it shows the culture, even though there's, you know, not a Holocaust, they're suffering from going from probably of an ancient Buddhist or Christian
yeah.
society
yeah.
into complete technology and overpopulated. You know,
yeah, driven by other extremes and pressures.
Yeah, yeah.
I've
heard of
fears what was happening even before technology. You know, the ethos of
Japanese or Eastern suicide is a different thing.
Yeah, but they go to one spot to do it. They could do it, but they're doing this for the suicide part of the ritual. There's another theory
about suicide, that it's the that people who are decisive find themselves trying to make a decision. They can't go that way, and they're blocked there, and they can't go that way, and they're blocked there. And the only thing they can think to do is then hurt themselves. It's not so much self-hatred, it's so much a complete, you know, blank.
Loss, where else can I go? Yeah.
And so that's the only thing that seems to be left when they feel they have to make a decision in a desperate situation. And so they can, then they, you know, stop thinking about anything else because they're on the other side of the decision. And I don't think the way we operate and think about things is totally different from anything they do in Asia, for, you know, something like suicide. And also I think for something like suicide, it's so complicated.
Yeah, it really is.
Definitely an individual
thing.
It has to be.
And there is, I mean, we have a friend who killed herself, and it was just a psychotic break. You know, it's just she was not in her right mind. It was just not, you know, and it was so horrific how she did it, and it was just so shocking. And she had
nobody had a clue. There was no signs.
Yes, she had had mental. She was manic depressive, but she was. Yeah, she was bipolar, and it was semi-controlled, sometimes controlled, but she was real, and she was a poet. She was a very gifted poet.
Well, that and Sam Sexton and Sylvia Plath, downsides of that. And
yes,
But is it higher now? Are the statistics higher in our society?
I don't know. I don't know. I thought the Swedes had the, you know, the suicide
euthanasia.
Index. Euthanasia. No, suicide, I thought.
Are you thinking of the hemlock society? I don't know.
It is up. Is that it?
They're a higher rate than other countries.
Mm.
And they think the rest of it would stop having no challenge or feeling of self. Boring.
Is taken care of. And it's also a very homogeneous country. Very homogeneous.
But when I look at it, if I ever get depressed, I just go, it's one way, and you don't come back. That's the one thing I say to myself. And I was wondering, my friend's daughter, and she's now a read count. She's also a parent. Well, no, that's
the 7th, if anybody can help the following week, except envelopes, which is
okay, I'll try to.
All right, good.
Okay.
Yeah, you'll get the lowdown.
I'm just trying to write on my calendar. I get so many emails and
oh,
I want to do. If I don't transfer them, I don't know what
me
to do.
Too. I will do
something today.
And the funny thing is, too, that there are two words for vegetables in Poland.
Yeah, well, yeah,
and Grosztyzna. And Grosztyzna comes from Poland.
What flavor is
word for
what's that?
Ginger.
Yeah, they're actually pretty good.
No, my son.
Your son?
Yeah.
How do they do early?